Dr. Claudia Dunsch. She's the Theodore F. Kennedy Associate Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering and Associate Vice Provost for Faculty Advancement at Duke University. She holds secondary appointments in the Nicholas School of Environment and the Department of Biomedical Engineering. She joined the Duke faculty in 2004 after obtaining her PhD from the University of Texas at Austin, her MS from Clemson University, and her BS from Purdue University. Currently, she serves as an associate director for the Duke Microbiome Center and as the director of integrative bioinformatics for investigating and engineering microbiomes. This is a joint graduate training program between Duke and North Carolina A&T State University. Her research bridges environmental engineering and molecular biotechnology. Currently, her research focus includes investigating the impacts of emerging contaminants on environmental microbiomes, developing technologies for improving bioremediation efficacy, studying microbial evolution following exposure to anthropogenic contaminants, and developing innovative water treatment technologies. Claudia, we're very excited for your presentation, and I'm going to turn the session over to you.
All right, thank you very much for that introduction. And thanks to the organizers for inviting me today to talk about some of our work in precision bioremediation. So as was mentioned, I'm an environmental engineer by training, and a lot of the research that we do in my lab incorporates concepts from molecular biology and some of the fundamental sciences. So what I'm going to do today is talk a little bit about really blend some of the more applied work that we have done with some of the more fundamental research that we have done in our lab. So I think all of you that are listening in today on today's webinar, being that it's on bioremediation, are well familiar with the fact that there are many hazardous waste sites that are in existence in the U.S. and worldwide. In the U.S. alone, there are more than 4,700 waste sites that have been identified, and it's staggering to think that nearly 53 million Americans live within 3 miles of a major hazardous waste site. And so even though we have made lots of progress in the area of cleaning up the environment, we still have a lot of problems that we need to solve. And so there's many technologies that have been developed throughout the years to remediate hazardous waste sites, and you'll recognize some of these strategies, so pump and treat, soil vapor extraction, excavation, capping, vitrification, and just to name a few. But some of the issues associated with these is that they can often be very intrusive on the environment themselves and can cause lots of long-term issues for those sites. And so we've spent a lot of time thinking about what are some in situ bioremediation techniques that are less intrusive and could be more sustainable in the long term. So I'm showing a figure up here of one of the, I would say, classic compounds that we treat using in situ bioremediation, trichloroethene. And the concept is very straightforward. We are utilizing microbes that exist in the subsurface to consume the pollutant and transform it into a more benign form of this compound, the parent compound. Now, there are inherent challenges with in situ bioremediation, the first one being very slow degradation if not stimulated properly, or even absence of degradation if the right microbial community is not present at a site. So in the field of in situ bioremediation, there are several approaches that can be taken. The first is to biostimulate your site, and biostimulation is achieved by adding specific nutrients to the subsurface to stimulate the indigenous microbes, so the microbes that are already present at your site, and those can then do their job and transform the contaminants into these non-toxic end products that that we are hoping to obtain. If there are no existing microbes present at the site, an alternate approach is bioaugmentation. And bioaugmentation consists of adding foreign microbes, so exogenous microbes, to the subsurface, to then perform those same features in situ. So bioaugmentation would be, for instance, if a researcher or a company had a suite of microbes that are known to degrade particular compounds, then those organisms could then be inputted into that environment to create that degradation, the biodegradation process. In some cases, we can combine biostimulation and bioaugmentation, and this has been shown to result in better biodegradation. But it's very clear that when we do biostimulation and bioaugmentation, that it's still very much a black box, and we need to get a better understanding of what is happening at the site, and each site has very specific characteristics that will dictate how successful this process will actually be. And in many cases, the amended microbes, especially in the case of bioaugmentation, those organisms are not able to propagate because they are unable to compete for important nutrient and resources under the given microbial ecological conditions at those sites. And so we clearly need to have a better understanding of all of those factors. So one of the approaches that we have worked with in our lab, and so I'll run through three different approaches that you'll see increasingly incorporate more omics into these approaches. The first approach that we have devised is what is called genetic bioaugmentation. And so genetic bioaugmentation, as the name implies, is relying on some exogenous strains. So this is, I was describing bioaugmentation, where we take these exogenous organisms and we add them to the subsurface. Often when we do that, those organisms are unable to survive. And so with the approach of genetic bioaugmentation, what we're doing is we're relying on extra chromosomal plasmids that contain the important genes needed for the degradation. And so you may have heard about horizontal gene transfer and particular conjugation in the context of antimicrobial resistance or antibiotic resistance genes, where plasmids are transferred between organisms. They're promiscuous and can enter into other cells through conjugation. And in that application, this is something where we're trying to control the transfer of those plasmids. In our application, we are trying to promote the transfer of these plasmids that contain the genes of interest. So conjugation, for those that are not familiar, this is a physical process that occurs when a pilus is formed between a cell that contains a fertile plasmid, so between a donor and a recipient cell. So there's a physical bridge, so to speak, that is formed between these two cells, and these plasmids can then be transferred into a recipient cell, that is present at the site. And by utilizing this technique, we can actually take advantage of existing microbes that are present at the site, which then removes this need for the exogenous strain long-term survival. I think I pushed the wrong button.
Hi, Claudia. Yeah, I think I need to re-upload the slides, so it will take a minute to get them back up.
Okay. All right. Sorry.
No problem.
thank you. So in genetic bioaugmentation, what we're doing, so we are adding this exogenous strain, which is the donor cell that contains this this plasmid, and taking advantage of the existing indigenous microbes at this at the site. The donor cell then transfers through conjugation its plasmid and forms transconjugants, which are shown here in purple. The transconjugants then should be able to convert the contaminant into these non-toxic products. And so, as I mentioned, the advantages of this would be that the donor cell doesn't need to survive for the bioremediation to occur. And also, the hypothesis is that you would need less foreign microbe addition to the site. So we utilized a system that was developed by Dr. Soren Molin out of the Danish Technical Institute, and this system utilizes a toluene degrading plasmid that is tagged with green fluorescent protein. And the way that the system works is that the green fluorescent protein is under the control of a promoter that is repressed in the donor cell. And once transferred to the recipient cell, that cell does not have that repressor protein, does not express that repressor protein, and so the cell fluoresces. And so it makes it very straightforward to be able to monitor for the presence of transconjugants in your sample. So we had cells, so Pseudomonas putative cells that contain the tall plasmid. We transferred the plasmid into E. coli cells, and as you can see, these E. coli cells, the transconjugant cells, now have this green fluorescent protein that you can easily identify through a microscope. Now, unfortunately, when even though we had shown that these organisms had all of the material that they needed, they had these plasmids, they had taken up these plasmids, when we assayed for toluene degradation, we discovered that even though the Pseudomonas putida controls could degrade toluene very effectively, as denoted by the dashed line with the triangles, our transconjugate could not degrade plasmid. And in fact, you can see from the shape of this curve that it was a flat line, just like our abiotic control. So that was an important lesson for us, that the fact that these plasmids were being transferred, that the cell had the genetic material it needed, that this conjugal transfer was not the same as a functional phenotype. And of course, with the goal of designing bioremediation technology that improves the degradation ability, this was a problem for us. So it's clear that for genetic bioaugmentation to work necessitates two important factors. One, a functional phenotype, that the catabolic genes do actually function, and high conjugal transfer rate so that your plasmid is actually taken up. We were able to trick the system to activate this pathway in our transconjugants. And so we tried a variety of different stimulations, so additional carbon sources. And in this particular case, I'm showing a figure that shows, as a function of glucose addition, increase in toluene degradation, as well as enzymatic activity for those particular pathways. But as you'll note from the bar on the far right for Pseudomonas putida bar over here on the right side of your screen, you can tell that the activity is much higher than any of the transconjugants that are denoted as having increased activity. And so we later discovered through a variety of different studies that this actually was an artifact. It was really linked to a stimulation of the some of the sigma factors, and was really a fortuitous occurrence, as opposed to us really fixing that pathway. So what So we went back to the drawing board and we're really trying to understand this. And what we discovered is that there's actually a very big impact of what the makeup of the genetic material of the plasmid relative to the parent cell that it's living in is. And so E. coli genome has a 50% GC content, whereas the Pseudomonas putative genome had a 60% GC content, and the top plasmid was 59%. So very close to the donor cell. And in fact, what we found is that there was a study that showed when they screened hundreds of different bacteria that contained plasmid, that there was a very high correlation between the GC content of the cells, the genomes, and their plasmid. And so you can see in this figure that there is almost, it's a straight line, and it's almost a one-to-one, correlation between the plasmid GC content and the host GC content. So this gave us some clues in terms of what to start looking for to match the plasmid that we're trying to conjugate and a recipient cell that we would want to take up this plasmid. So we tested this hypothesis, and we knew that this toluene plasmid had a 59% GC content, so we looked for a variety of different bacteria that we could conjugate or that we could develop transconjugant with this plasmid. And I'm showing here a phylogenetic tree with a variety of different transconjugants that we developed. And so you can see that there's a range of GC contents ranging from the 50% E. coli strain that we started our study with, all the way to a couple of Pseudomonas putida or Pseudomonas-related organisms with the 60% or higher GC content, similar to our donor strain. And what we found is that there was a high correlation between both the genomic GC content and phylogenetic relatedness and activity. And so what this figure is showing right here on the primary x-axis, the genomic GC content, and the secondary x-axis is the phylogenetic distance from donor, keeping in mind that zero, smaller the number, the higher relatedness exists between the donor and the recipient. And then on the y-axis is the specific toluene degradation. And so there was a very high percentage as your GC content becomes closer to the genomic content of your donor, you can start seeing that activity start increasing. And similarly, as your relatedness starts decreasing, that activity also decreases. And so again, this gave us some indication as far as what organisms to target for this genetic bioaugmentation approach. So we followed up with some soil column experiments that were closely mimicking activity that might occur at an actual site. As shown right here, so we had soil columns with a variety of different soils and also microbial mixtures in them, and then monitored over time the presence of the transconjugants and then also the activity itself. And so we had some controls. And then we had some autoclaved material with just the strains, and then some subsequent carbon addition, and then some mixed communities, so the non-sterile soil, with those glucose input. And we then followed the over time. We were interested in understanding with the selective pressure what would happen to the microbial community and the degradation ability of that the resulting microbial community. And what we found is that degradation did increase over time, and once we removed the selective pressure, that microbial community did come back to where it was initially. So this this first approach that I described right here demonstrates that it is possible to induce these horizontal gene transfers of catabolic plasmid. However, to obtain the functional phenotype that really is what we are after for bioremediation really requires either luck, and in our case, we had a little bit of that when we added the glucose and saw an increase in the functional phenotype and the degradation of toluene, or a knowledge of the host phylogenetic genetics and the phylogenetic relatedness. And this often becomes an issue when we are working with unknown organisms, which we often are at these sites that we are working with. And so this leads me to the second approach that really relies on using these next generation sequencing approaches. And so we at Duke, I am part of a Superfund center that is directed by Rich DiGiulio and Heather Stapleton at the Nicklaus School here. And I serve as the PI on the engineering project. And the work that we do as part of the center is largely focused on a couple of sites here in North Carolina as well as in Virginia. And so the Superfund sites, there are over 1,300 national priority Superfund sites, which are depicted up here on this figure, and I'm pointing out one of them that we've spent a lot of time working at. The contaminants of interest for this work have been polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. This class of compounds is often has been identified to be hazardous and has adverse health effects. Some of these compounds have been shown to be mutagenic, toxicogenic, genotoxic, carcinogenic, you name it. There's some of these compounds have been found to have these effects. So these compounds are often found in complex mixtures, and the sites that we have been interested in are those where there's been wood treatment activity. And so that's what this figure or this picture here is demonstrating or is showing, some of the wood before it is treated. And then you can see over here on the left side after it's been treated. So it has these PAHs are organic compounds that have these fused rings as demonstrated up here in these model PAHs, naphthalene, anthracene, and pyrene. So the two sites that we have worked on, one is this Republic creosoting site at the Elizabeth River, which is shown up here in Virginia. This particular site was operated from the 1930s to the 1970s, and was a site where there was wood treatment. And this particular site feeds into the Elizabeth River, is near another site that we worked at, Atlantic Woods. The second site that we work at is the Holcomb Creosote facility. This site is located in Yadkinville, North Carolina, and this site was listed as a national priorities site in 2012. This site also was used for wood treatment, but has some different characteristics in terms of it's not on the coast, and so some of the tidal influences that we see with our other site are not present here. So we were interested in going to these sites and really starting to look at what are the microbial fingerprints at these sites, and looking for correlations between the microbial fingerprints and the biogeochemical and the chemical fingerprints at these sites. And so we're particularly interested at looking at some of these cross-kingdom interactions and thinking about how can we take advantage of fungal ability to degrade very complex and larger molecule compounds such as these polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons to transform them into metabolites that are more bioavailable to bacteria. And so what we have done is go and collect numerous samples from each of these sites and ran through some next generation sequencing analyses of a variety of different targets, and for both fungal and bacterial counterparts, and use this information, decipher this information to look for potential targets for bioremediation. And so we've looked at the 18S LSU region for fungi. We've looked at the ITS region, several of the ITS regions, as well as 16S for bacteria. And so I'm going to just show a couple of analyses that we've done on these. So the general concept for performing an amplicon-based metagenomic community analysis is similar regardless of the target that that you use. You go to your site, extract, collect samples, extract DNA, amplify particular regions of that DNA, and then run through several pipelines to look for and to classify your reads to be able to determine who is present at your site. And so some of the findings that we found, so this is data that my student Lauren Chaprisky had done a number of years ago that is on the sites in Virginia. We were interested in understanding what does this microbial fingerprint for fungi specifically look like with increasing PAH concentration. And so this figure right here shows this what that fingerprint looks like with increasing pH concentration as we move over towards the right, and shows the relative abundance of fungal phyla. And so one of the interesting takeaways from this is that as we increase the pH concentration, we start seeing an increase in these dark purple fungi that fall under the Ascomycota phylum. And so this gives us some targets in terms of what might be some of the fungi that we can target to carry out these first steps in the biodegradation pathways of interest to us. Similarly, for bacteria, we can run through a similar analysis, and this was work that was performed by a student of mine, Lauren Redfern, at the Holcomb creosote site. And so this is also showing relative abundance of different bacterial phyla. And we can then further break it down based off of this information and really dive into specific types of bacteria. And so based off of this, we've developed kind of a how-to guide about how would you carry this out at your site, all the way from looking at the isolating your nucleic acid, doing the sequencing, looking at these relationships, and identifying what might be particular strains that you could target for genetic bioaugmentation, and biostimulation. And I would encourage you, if you want more information, I will reference the paper that we just published in the Journal of Hazardous Materials on this topic. So the next step, and really where we're spending a lot of time now, is really trying to decipher this very complex information that we obtain from these next generation sequencing data sets, with the idea that functionally these communities have lots of similarity. But when we start looking at taxonomic differences, there's a lot of diversity. And so really trying to get at this question of how can we ask the question about the function, which is really what we're after, based off of the this taxonomic information that we have. And so we are working on developing some approaches that really take this information that we get from the taxonomic descriptions and breaking it down into modules, and start really understanding how these different modules fit together, if certain organisms might work synergistically together, or they might be competing, and starting to get some information about how each of these sites can be broken down more systematically. And so a lot of the work that we're doing right now is looking at exchangeability of these modules, trying to really understand the correlations and the connections between the different parts of these microbial communities. And so this is really where we are heading, and we are currently running some experiments looking at, with PAHs and without PAHs, how these communities change over time, so that we can start getting at this question and building these particular modules. So with that, I will stop my presentation, and I have a lot of people that I need to acknowledge. This is a picture of a couple of my research groups at different points in time, but certainly Daniel Rodriguez up here has done a lot of the work that's related to the mathematical modeling that is underway, and then Savannah Volkoff and Lauren Redfern did a lot of the bacterial work, and then Lauren Chaplisky has done a lot of the fungal work. And then I'd like to acknowledge our funders, so NIEHS through the Superfund Research Program, and then some of the earlier work that I presented on the genetic bioaugmentation was funded through the National Science Foundation, and then my collaborators on this project. So with that, I would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you for a great presentation, Claudia. We do have some questions that have come in, so let's read some of those to you. The first questioner wants to know, how does the GC content increase the functionality? Does it modify any gene functional units, such as promoter coding sequences, et cetera?
So that's a great question. The way that it really increases the functionality is through, it's actually because of the tRNAs. So the different organisms have different makeup of tRNAs that they use. And so it's really more through the ability to make more of the right protein is how it gets at the functionality. So that would be if we're transferring plasmids between different organisms, where there might be different machineries in those different organisms. In our particular case with the E. coli, what was happening is there was a cascading effect that was linked to the sigma factors that were involved in that were needed for the regulation of that particular system. So it was a fortuitous reaction, I guess, to the system.
Okay, great, thanks. And I do want to remind everyone that you can submit questions using the Q&A pod in the lower right-hand corner of your screen at any time during the presentation. So please, we do encourage you to keep submitting your questions, and there may probably be some time at the end if you think of something once we move into the next presentation. But while we're waiting for more questions to come in, I wanted to offer up the people on the phone lines. If you'd like to ask a question, you can take your phone off mute by pressing #6. You can state who you are and your organization and ask your question, remembering that you can remute your phone by pressing *6. So at this point, is there anyone on the phone who has unmuted themselves and wants to ask a question? Okay. Well, we'll keep you in mind as we move along. I do know that the majority of the presentations are on Adobe Connect, and we did have another couple of questions come in, so I'll just move on here. This participant states that the transfer of catabolic plasmids to random recipients also carries the risk of co-carrying antibacterial resistant genes like kanamycin, which is already a huge problem, and I guess they're just asking what your thoughts are on this.
Yeah, so that's an important point to make. So in our particular case, the plasmid that we were transferring actually does contain the kanamycin resistance gene, and so this wouldn't be necessarily a plasmid that would be used in this particular setting. But there's a number of metabolic plasmids, naturally occurring catabolic plasmids that do not contain those antibiotic resistance genes. So it's really, it's very variable depending on the plasmid that you are aiming to transfer.
Okay. All right, we have another question here, wanting to know if you have any suggestions on how to anticipate or prevent accumulations of toxic metabolites such as vinyl chloride.
Yeah, so that's also a great question. It's really, the more we know about the pathways, the more we can think about what are the right modifications and interventions to implement at a given site. And so for vinyl chloride specifically, thinking about the microbes that are needed to further break down the vinyl chloride to ethene, for instance, and really understanding how those organisms can either be stimulated or allowed to compete more effectively under the actual conditions at a given site. And so it really boils down to understanding in that more complex microbial community how the specific targeted organism of interest can function optimally to achieve the function, in this particular case, the vinyl chloride degradation.
Okay, great. Another question we received is, this person wants to know, what are the biggest technical challenges to field implementation of precision bioremediation?
So there are clearly a lot of challenges that are still left for us to be able to do this in a systematic fashion. The number one challenge, I would say, is really the depth of our databases. And so we are relying on databases to identify the organisms that are present at the site. And if those databases are not deep enough, meaning that we cannot identify the organism, then we cannot design create optimal implementation at that particular site. So that's a big issue. I would say the bacterial databases are a little bit deeper than the archaea or the eukaryotic or the fungi databases, and so this is a problem that we run into. But as more people are in this line of work, those databases are likely to deepen. The second challenge is really that we're often chasing very rare taxa, and so we really are often looking for a needle in a haystack. And so when you couple that with maybe not even knowing what you're looking for in the first place, just points to the fact that we just need more information. And again, as we build these models and we deepen our databases, we will be able to do that in a more systematic fashion, identifying these taxa. And then the final challenge that I'll mention, at least in this context, is really the sites where we're working at, and this is one of the big differences when we're working between a lab or a real site, is the high level of heterogeneity. And so we might think that we have a particular microbial community at some part of our site, when if you just go a few feet over, you might have a very different microbial composition. And so really, getting at this question of heterogeneity is an important challenge, and understanding even how far do you need to collect, what is the size of the grid for sampling that is needed. All of those are important features.
Okay. Well, Claudia, I want to thank you for your great presentation. I think we're going to move on to the next presenter. We just got another question come in. Maybe I'll pause there and read this one. This person wrote in, I am working on a remediation project where we have some challenges in bioremediating weathered crude oil. Most of the contaminants present is C40 plus, which are asphatines and resins. Will you be able to suggest strains of microbial species that have the genomes capable of biodegrading such resistant compounds?
So if that person that submitted that question could send me an email, I would be happy to talk with them offline. Depending on the approaches that we're relying on really are thinking about what are fungi that would be able to degrade those into compounds that then the bacteria could attack, but it would probably be optimal to think about at that particular site who are the microbial players that are present, as opposed to putting in an exogenous strain that might not compete. So, but I'd be happy to talk offline about that.
Okay, great. Yeah, and just a reminder to our participants, you can find the presenter's contact information on the main seminar page where you registered for today's live event. Okay, well, thank you, Claudia. I think we're going to move on to our next presenter, who is Julian Schroeder. And Dr. Julian Schroeder is a Novartis Chair and Distinguished Professor in the Division of Biological Sciences at the University of California in San Diego. He is also co-director of the Center for Food and Fuel for the 21st Century at UC San Diego. He received his PhD working with Erwin Neher at the Max Planck Institute for Biophysical Chemistry in Göttingen, Germany, and was a von Humboldt postdoctoral fellow at UCLA School of Medicine. He has pioneered characterizations of plant ion channels, which led to models of their unique functions in plant biology. He also pioneered functional characterizations of genes encoding plant ion transport proteins and their roles in stress tolerance. His present research has identified mechanisms and genes that allow plants to withstand environmental stresses, in particular, responses to elevated CO2, drought, salinity stress, and heavy metal stress. Julian, I think we're turning it over to you now.
Yes, thank you very much, Michelle. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you sound good.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Michelle. Also, thanks to Heather and Sarah and Bill and the Superfund team for the opportunity to present our research. And I will be speaking to you about toxic heavy metals as well as arsenic, the metalloid arsenic. And we, of course, heard very nicely from Claudia just now about how microbes can be used to degrade organic toxicants. And, of course, in the case of these metals and metalloid arsenic, we don't have microbes that can, say, do nuclear fission or fusion to modify these into non-toxic compounds. So this is a challenge. And as you can see in this slide, there are many sources of these toxicants, both industrially and in applications, including on the top left, even pesticide use, as I may mention again later, and treatment of woods through arsenic, and so on. And there are, of course, particularly in the case of arsenic, also large natural areas where these are found. So if we, obviously, we have many Superfund sites here in the U.S., and we have a national priority list of toxicants. And if we look here on the right, we will see that some of the highest priority toxicants fall into these categories of the heavy metals, cadmium, mercury, lead, and the metalloid arsenic. And so how can these be removed from the environment? And research and also applications have shown that plants provide tools that can be used for removal of heavy metals. First of all, how are these heavy metals and arsenic taken up into the plant? And that is, as research in several laboratories has found, through nutrient transporters. So those nutrient transporters are obviously needed. For example, arsenate is taken up through phosphate transporters. From there, plants can translocate these metals into aerial portions, and plants have particularly strong mechanisms for detoxification and accumulation of these metals. So there are certain, there are a number of species of plants that are called hyperaccumulators because they can accumulate large amounts of these metals and arsenic. And often these plants are quite small in stature. So obviously one would, it would be interesting to know the molecular mechanisms and networks and pathways by which plants can detoxify and overaccumulate these metals in order to then implement these, for example, in bioremediating trees or plants. I want to give you some examples of major detoxification mechanisms for all of the toxicants that I mentioned earlier, and that goes back to a lot of this research is done in the plant Arabidopsis thaliana, which, as one of my colleagues likes to say, is the lab rat or the Drosophila fruit fly of the plant world, meaning it's very useful for genomic approaches and for discovering gene functions. Now, what we have here is a mutant and wild-type plants grown under control conditions, and let me see if I can get the pointer on, under control conditions, and they look very similar. However, if we expose these plants, for example, to cadmium, you can see how this mutant here is highly sensitive to cadmium, while a complemented line is less sensitive. We and two other groups identified the gene that's responsible for this cadmium detoxification, and, well, I should say cadmium resistance here. And it turns out, using various several approaches, it turns out that the underlying gene encodes a enzyme called phytochelatin synthase. So what does phytochelatin synthase do? It uses glutathione as a substrate, and glutathione is a short peptide consisting here of three amino acids. And this phytochelatin synthase is a so-called transpeptidase that uses glutathione to synthesize long chains of these amino acids that are rich in cysteine, so glutamate, cysteine, glycine, whereby this can be 2 to 11 copies. So these are long peptides that are cysteine-rich. And these peptides, these phytochelatins, are particularly good at binding heavy metals and also arsenite, as we will see. So sort of to expand on the slide we just saw, here we have plants grown in plates under control conditions or in the presence of arsenate, mercury, or cadmium. And if we home in here, for example, if we look at this mutant that's deficient in this phytochelatin synthase, in the presence of arsenic, we also see that it's highly sensitive. We also see that it's highly sensitive in the presence of mercury and cadmium. While if we look at the wild-type plants, they are relatively resistant. So this single gene plays a role in resistance to all of these toxicants. Now, what's the underlying, or how can we further explain this and understand this? So if we look, when a heavy metal such as cadmium enters a cell, it binds to these phytochelatins very tightly. In fact, the cysteines are very important for this binding. A next step in detoxification is that these phytochelatin metal complexes then are transported into plant vacuoles. Now, the transporter had been unknown, though research a number of years ago had suggested that this transporter may be an ABC transporter, a so-called ATP binding cassette transporter. So since not many advances had been made in collaboration with Enrico Martinoi at the University of Zurich in Switzerland, we did more experiments that indeed suggested this unknown transporter is an ABC binding cassette transporter. So what is the underlying gene? Well, that's a challenge in plants. As we can see here on the left, even in the plant Arabidopsis, there are over 120 ABC transporter genes, making it very difficult to identify the proper gene. Now, in our research on phytochelatin synthase, we and others found that the fission yeast, S. pombi, also encode phytochelatin synthases. So speculation was that these plants and also can accumulate phytochelatin synthase metals in their vacuoles. Now, interesting, fission yeast has only 11 ABC transporters. So we use this as a model to see if we could identify such transporters in fission yeast and also in Arabidopsis in collaboration with Enrico Martinoi and Yong-Suk Lee at Pohang in Korea. And this research led to basically two parallel important advances. In S. pombi, we were able to identify ABC transporters that mediate this response of transporting toxicant or heavy metal and arsenic phytochelatin complexes into vacuoles and thereby sequestering them away. And we also identified genes in the plant Arabidopsis. Now, let me show you an example of what that looks like in Arabidopsis here in the next slide. So what we're seeing here again on the left are plants growing in control plates without toxicants, the wild-type plants, plants in which we've knocked out one of the genes we identified, or the other gene in the ABC transporter family, or a double mutant. Now, if you expose these plants, for example, to an arsenic-based pesticide, disodium methyl arsenate, you will see that the wild-type plant is able to withstand that because it can detoxify the arsenic through the phytochelatin pathway and sequester that in vacuoles. The single knockout mutants in these genes are also fairly resistant because there are two genes. But if you knock out both genes, you get a huge sensitivity. Now, you can also do experiments rather than adding this pesticide, directly adding, in this case, arsenite, and you see how particularly the double knockout is sensitive, but it's very difficult to distinguish the wild type and the single mutants. So in summary, what we have shown here is that important genes, the phytochelatin synthase. It synthesizes these peptides that can bind heavy metals, and then the transporters have been identified. And I will get back to these later in my talk, but I do want to sort of switch more to the subject of today, namely omic, genomic omic methods to identify mechanisms in bioremediation. As omic or systems level, as we like to say, also approaches to address functional genetic redundancy. Now, why is that important? What am I referring to here with functional genetic redundancy? Well, when the first plant genome was sequenced and genomes from other organisms were sequenced, this goes back almost 20 years ago, it became immediately clear that plant genomes have much larger gene families than other organisms, and often they have many gene copies of a type of gene. I just gave you the example of the ABC transporters, where we have in plants over 120 ABC transporter genes. And so since that time, many genomes have been sequenced, and that is a major issue in plants. If you want to discover gene and molecular functions, the fact that there are multiple copies of genes and redundancy can make this difficult, as I just showed you in the example of the ABC transporters, where single mutants barely show any phenotype. So we wanted to, in fact, say in the model plant or in the lab plant Arabidopsis thaliana, there are about 29,000 protein-encoding genes. Of those, the function of single mutant phenotypes have maybe been identified for 10% of those. And then there's some higher order mutants where you knock out, for example, two genes, as I just showed you. So we have shown functional phenotypes to maybe 15% of those 29,000 genes. But what about the other 85% of the genes? How can we identify their functions? So this was a challenge that we posed ourselves, and when Felix Hauser joined my laboratory, we decided we are going to try to use an approach of artificial microRNAs to silence closely homologous genes in different combinations genome-wide while not targeting off targets. So how do we do this? Well, first Felix had to generate an annotation of all genes and gene families in the Arabidopsis genome using 16 different annotations indicated by the red dots. And from that analysis, he found that about 22,000 genes in the Arabidopsis genome belong to gene families. And next, computationally designed microRNAs that can co-silence closely homologous genes without off targets. That's not a trivial approach, and we use the supercomputer center here at UCSD and the Triton cluster of 2,048 parallel CPUs and about 90,000 hours of CPU time to compute such microRNAs in diverse combinations of targeting different subsets of genes. And so a result of this was that Felix ended up designing 2 million, over 2 million artificial microRNAs that in different combinations usually target about 2 to 5 genes that would then be silenced. Using this approach, we were able to target combinations of 18,000 genes, so not all of the gene families, because you need conserved nucleotides without off targets. And of course, this is a resource that many other labs are using, and we've set up this phantom database at UCSD where people, if they have certain genes that they want to co-silence, they can go in there, see if they can identify appropriate microRNAs that then target their combination of genes. Well, that's fine, but 2 million artificial microRNAs is too many in order to do forward genetic screening, random screening for mutants, for example, that are more tolerant or more sensitive to toxicants. So among these 2 million, Felix selected 22,000 22,000 artificial microRNAs that also target these same 18,000 genes in different combinations. And because that's also a lot to screen for, we divided these into 10 sublibraries. Now, let's say you're particularly interested in transcription factors that turn on genes that may give you resistance or accumulation of a metal. So one of these libraries targets DNA binding, predicted DNA binding protein families, and RNA binding proteins. Another of these sublibraries targets gene families of unknown function, particularly interesting to discover new mechanisms. Let me sort of give you an example of how these microRNAs work here. So in this diagram, in this cartoon, the five red boxes are five highly homologous genes. Now, let's assume if you knock out this gene alone or this, you don't see a phenotype because they kind of cover for each other, genetic redundancy or overlapping functions. So here's a the microRNAs are shown in green. Here's a microRNA that targets these two genes to knock them down, to silence them. That could give us a phenotype. But not every microRNA is highly efficient when designed on an omic scale, even though we try to develop those with particularly high binding affinities. Very often, we have a second microRNA targeting other nucleotides of those two genes and even reaching out to target a third gene. And let's say these two genes would have to be mutated to get a phenotype. Here's a microRNA targeting these two genes and that gene, and here's another microRNA targeting these two and that. So this combinatorial effect should enhance robustness in our ability to screen. Now, the next challenge of this project, we had to create transgenic plants and that express these microRNAs for laboratory screening. And so Felix, Paolo, and a team designed these, and we developed and we did some proof of concept screens. For example, my laboratory is also interested in drought tolerance, and using this approach, we were very quickly able to isolate receptors for hormones that mediate drought tolerance in a very short time, and these receptors had been searched for several decades. That was, of course, a proof of concept since those receptors were now isolated 10 years ago. And we've done different survival screens. Now, in the case of heavy metals and arsenic, here's an example of a mutant that we identified. First of all, on the left, we see the wild type and this particular artificial microRNA expressing line in the absence of a toxicant. In the presence of arsenic, actually, this artificial microRNA carrying line grows better than the wild type. So it's more resistant, you could say, in root growth. So what genes among the 22 or 18,000 genes are targeted by this microRNA? Well, it happens to be three phosphate transporters. Now, that intuitively makes sense because, as I mentioned earlier, how is arsenic or arsenate taken up into roots? Well, through phosphate transporters. And if you knock down some phosphate transporters, perhaps your roots are more resistant. And we are further investigating these. Let me sort of, so the first step usually when we identify and confirm such a line is we identify the microRNA sequence that tells us what the potential targets are, but then we retransform other plants to see if we can confirm the phenotype. That's the first step, and that's shown in this slide. So what you can see here is we retransformed, let's see, my pointer, So we retransformed this microRNA, and again, you can see improved root growth compared to the wild-type control here. So I will get back to this in a minute. I want to show you another example of an interesting artificial microRNA. We've, of course, isolated many lines and are characterizing many genes now using a number of approaches. So I'm just showing you a few examples here. Here's another interesting and curious example. So this is in the absence of a stress. These plants, the wild type and this particular line, seem to be growing similarly well. And if we look on the right here, in the presence of arsenite, this line carrying this microRNA is actually, again, the roots are growing longer than the wild type. Interestingly for this line, if we analyze the sensitivity to cadmium, we actually see more sensitivity than the wild type, while for arsenic, we see more root growth than the wild type. So we don't always get identical phenotypes for these. And so let's kind of dig in a little bit here and ask what's going on. Now, this microRNA, the first question is, what genes is it predicted to target? And we can see here, this microRNA targets 6 genes. Now, that's a little bit unusual because 96% of the microRNAs that are in our libraries target 2 to 5 genes. And that has an advantage that once you identify the candidate target genes, you then have an easier time narrowing them down. The more targets you have, the more work you have. So in this case, of these 6 genes, 2 of them are related, as shown here, by these ERF transcription factors, 34 and 35. And the other 4 are also related. Those are CBF-type transcription factors. And we also can, using hybridization energy, determine which ones are most likely to be knocked down compared to those that are least less likely. So since these are 2 different gene families, we knocked out members of this family and that family to then investigate their responses. And so you in my lab, using a CRISPR approach, knocked out 3 of the 4 CBF family members. If you knock out all 4, you'll get lethality. And so what we see here under control conditions, the plants are doing looking similar. In the presence of arsenite, we see an apparent longer root growth in this triple mutant compared to wild type. So this is similar to the phenotype we saw in the original microRNA line. Although, as I said, we didn't knock out the CBF4 or the ERFs, so we are recapitulating that phenotype or certainly part of that. Now, a question is, why? How does this occur? These are transcription factors. What are their targets? And one omics method to identify transcription factor targets these days is a method of ChIP-seq, and there's also a variant of that used in Arabidopsis called DAP-seq, and we can ask, where in the genome do these transcription factors potentially bind? And if we look at this for these CBF transcription factors, indeed we find members of phosphate transporter families, in fact, not only those that we identified, but also other members. So these are putative candidates, but this might explain why these transcription factor mutants affect the phenotype in response to arsenite, and there may be a link to the other mutant we found that targets phosphate transporters. Now, we are investigating that question further. That's ongoing research, and let me show you just some of the data on this. So we first asked in wild type. Here we're looking at one of those 3 phosphate transporters we identified earlier. And what you can see in wild type is it is expressed at a certain level, but if you expose your plants to arsenic, that is reduced. And that makes sense because plants take up arsenate through phosphate transporters. So what about in our CRISPR triple mutant in the CBFs? If we look at this phosphate transporter, even before you expose it to arsenic, it's already down. One interpretation of this is that the CBF transcription factor is responsible for enhancing the expression of this transporter. If you knock them out, the expression level is lower. In the presence of arsenic, it doesn't get further reduced. But this might, in part, explain the increased root growth in the presence of arsenic that we identified in our artificial microRNA line. Now, that's one of the genes. What if we look at the other 2? Now, this other one that we had knocked down, you don't see a clear difference in the wild type or in the CRISPR mutant. And in this one, there may be a difference, but it's not as pronounced as in this one. But if we knock down all 3 of these, we see a phenotype. If we knock out only one of these, we don't, meaning these genes and phosphate transporters can contribute to the phenotype in our phosphate, at least for our phosphate mutant. And on the expression level, it appears that this is an important target of these transcription factors. That's a hypothesis, I should say, that we're further investigating. Let me show you another example of this type of research. And in other words, remember that our transcription factor artificial microRNA targeted four CBF genes and two ERF 34 and 35 genes. So here, she has knocked out the two ERF 34 and 35 genes and created a double mutant. In the absence of stress, there may be an effect, but it's not very dramatic. And now we're looking at the cadmium response. Remember that the artificial microRNA line was more sensitive to cadmium. And in this double mutant, we're seeing an enhanced sensitivity of growth. It may not be identical at this point to the microRNA that targets more genes, but certainly this is an important similar phenotype. So now another question is, well, these are also transcription factors, and which genes might they induce? And she had a very interesting idea. We have previously published, and also others have published, microarray data where they've asked, which genes does cadmium strongly induce in the Arabidopsis genome? And you get a long list of genes from that. And then we can use the DAPSeq, ChIP-seq approach to ask which DNA elements in the genome do these two transcription factors bind. And then we can do a correlation between the binding to DNA and cadmium-induced gene expression. And interestingly, when she did this, and it may be hard to read, the top gene in the list that shows the strongest cadmium induction is a nitrate transporter called nitrate transporter 1.8. Now, the reason that's interesting, actually, in the previous Superfund supported research, we identified this transporter as playing a role in cadmium sensitivity, and they're linked to nitrate transporter in the plant. I won't go into this, but a former postdoc in my lab, Ji-Ming Gong, identified this in my lab. He set up his own lab where we then completed the study. And what you can see here under control conditions, just a single mutant in this transporter doesn't show much difference, or if we complement the mutant. But in the presence of cadmium and nitrate, we see this slight sensitivity. So there may be, again, a correlation here. We're identifying putative elements of networks. Of course, more work is needed. We're in the early days of this research. But I wanted to show you some examples where we find transporter genes and also transcription factors that may be linked to them, and obviously we're following up on that. So let me sort of summarize this part of my talk. There are very large gene families and many large gene families in plants, disproportionately compared to other organisms. And that has limited gene discovery and forward genetic screens of important genes in plants. So we've developed an omics resource using artificial microRNAs in our screening for new mutants in arsenic and cadmium responses. And this omics resource is not only useful for our research, but obviously other laboratories are now starting to use it. We generated these lines and provided them to the Arabidopsis Stock Center so that now, since early this year, other laboratories can also pursue these screens, and we can identify important genes within the large gene families found in plants. So, all right. Now, in the rest of my talk, because obviously we are interested, and I'm sure the listeners are interested in questions of bioremediation, I wanted to mention some of this basic science that we're doing and how one could relate that to the field. In other words, translating from the lab to the field. Of course, we're in early days, but as I've mentioned already earlier, my laboratory has an interest in how plants respond to drought. And in fact, some years ago, we identified a first plant mutant that we could show is more drought tolerant than its wild type control. These plants haven't been watered for 26 days, and the mutant is more resistant to drought. Now, this particular mutant also has other phenotypes, but we further characterize this with the McCourt lab. Now, I was very excited when Raina Meyer at the Superfund Center in Arizona and I started talking about possible interactions, since as Raina presented on Monday within this webinar series, she's very interested in plants that can survive on toxicants at low pH and toxic metals in arid and semi-arid regions. at the Iron King mine, for example, here where that Reyna's program works on. And Reyna's laboratory has identified and characterized plants that can grow under these conditions. And as she presented on Monday, this is important because also the ground cover of resistant plants will reduce dust in response to winds that then distribute toxicants to neighboring communities, respiratory diseases and so on, and other diseases linked to that. So we've started a collaboration, and in this case, an important aspect of these plants is that they can survive these conditions and grow. And not only that, but Reyna's laboratory is interested in the microbiome and how that plays a role in this resistance. Priyanka Kushwaha in Reyna's lab has grown plants in the presence of different concentrations of compost that includes microbes that are being characterized at the University of Arizona through genomic methods. And at the same time, then Chi Lee in my laboratory isolated messenger RNA samples from different tissues under these different conditions. And recently, Priyanka has visited, the RNA-seq experiments. We've had 48 samples thus far, where a sequence in Ron Evans' laboratory at the Salk Institute, who's a member of our Superfund Center, and Alexandria Tran in my laboratory, and also Chris Benner, a member of our Superfund Center here, has helped with these large data sets. This is ongoing analysis since we recently obtained this data, and this is just a slide that also Reyna showed on Monday from Priyanka's analyses. So what we're looking at here are plants treated with a 10% compost versus the 20% compost, and different replicates in roots. And you can see here there are, for example, genes that are clearly reproducibly induced under the higher compost treatment than the lower compost treatment, and other genes that are repressed or less expressed under the higher compost treatment compared to the lower. And of course, there are many genes that are being identified in parallel. Reyna's laboratory is looking at the microbiome of these different plants. And at the same time, we're seeing many genes, and we can compare these to our identified genes and the genes that we're identifying in our artificial microRNA screen. So that's ongoing work, and Reyna presented this Monday, but I wanted to briefly refer to it. In the last part of my talk, I want to mention another aspect of toxicants and how we as humans are exposed to them. So this is from Consumers Report from a few years ago, where at that time some of the listeners may recall that it was found that these concentrated apple juice and grape juice, this is that we gave our children to go to school, contained elevated levels of arsenic. So these toxicants, arsenic or lead, can make it into our food chain. And so one question is, how does that happen, and what can we do about it? It's not only fruit juice. It's also, for example, some of our staple crops, rice, as an example, rice grain, the seeds in rice, that are they are very good at accumulating arsenic and cadmium. Now, for rice grown in the U.S., particularly in southeastern U.S., that's more humid and well-suited for rice growth, we have elevated arsenic in the soils. Where does that come from? Well, it comes from, in part, those arsenic-containing pesticides that have been used in the past and cotton that was grown and treated with those pesticides, as well as natural reserves of arsenic. So plants are very good at accumulating arsenic and cadmium in the seeds that we eat, and there have been studies, for example, from the Dartmouth Superfund Center on human exposure through rice in the U.S. So as I mentioned, we have discovered mechanisms by which plants take up, sequester, detoxify, and also translocate these toxicants in the plants. But can we use these in the laboratory as a proof of concept to work on engineering approaches to deal with this? Now, in terms of how these toxicants enter the roots, I mentioned early in my talk that they do this by nutrient transporters. And it's very difficult to remove nutrient transporters because your plants require nutrients, and there are many of those genes in parallel. So one question was, can we, at least as a proof of concept in the laboratory, use some of our discoveries and those of others in the field to sequester these when they enter roots in the roots or expel them again so they don't end up in the grain as in the case of rice? So to do this, we needed promoters that can target roots. And we've used an Arabidopsis promoter, as shown here, with a reporter gene that can target roots, but less so the aerial parts of the plant. Now, the big challenge was to find a promoter in rice, and through a collaboration, we found a very strong promoter that targets rice roots, but not the aerial sections. So can we actually do this? Is this even realistical to think? And again, this is a laboratory proof of concept. If we identify mechanisms, again, there, genetic variation that exists in the field could be leveraged to target such genes either through genetic modification, but also through advanced molecular breeding, because through the revolution in genome sequences, knowledge can be targeted in non-GMO approaches potentially in to do this. And there is actually some evidence that that's feasible in rice in the case of cadmium. But, you know, can we sequester or keep toxicants out of the aerial part of the plant? We actually have previously demonstrated this in a different project that I'll just briefly mention in my laboratory, and that one of the metals that's toxic to plants, though less so to us, are sodium ions. And when we irrigate crops, sodium salt builds up in soils, and sodium is particularly toxic when it moves into the leaves. So, of course, plants and evolution, there is a mechanism that protects from this, and we discovered this. These are so-called HKT transporters. And the way this works is that sodium, together with water and nutrients, moves through the xylem in plants to reach leaves. And as water and nutrients are moving up the xylem, in the root particularly, you have these HKT transporters that pull the sodium out of the xylem stream and retain the sodium in the roots, where it then is sequestered in vacuoles or exported. And now let's say you knock out this single gene in our lab plant, Arabidopsis. What happens if you knock it out and you water the plants once with sodium chloride? Well, the wild type is able to withstand it because it keeps the sodium in the roots, but not the mutant. Okay, well, that's interesting. And as I just mentioned, now if we look at variation that actually occurs in nature, breeders in Australia and also in other regions have looked at rice and wheat, and it turns out that major salt tolerance loci, existing quantitative trait loci in wheat and in rice, use this mechanism to keep sodium out of the leaves. So presently, breeders are using this to improve wheat and rice in the field through non-GMO breeding approaches, and that this research started through this kind of basic gene discovery and mechanism that we've done in my laboratory, but then also, obviously, the breeders' contributions are very important there. So back to heavy metals, we, through work in various laboratories, know mechanisms of nutrient transporters, how these enter the plants. I mentioned the phytochilotins and the ABC transporters. There are also other pathways that these can be sequestered into vacuoles. There are a number of genes in this network that have been identified and that we are identifying. And so we are presently investigating in Arabidopsis and rice which combinations of genes and which genes could be used to reduce the transfer of these toxicants to the grain, as an example of rice. And so this is ongoing work. We actually now have some transgenic plants that we're growing up to collect seeds that were transformed with our right roots promoter and targeting different genes that we're testing with the help of Pam Ronald at UC Davis, who works on rice and has transformed these for us. So this is ongoing work, and obviously I think it's a challenge because the question is which combinations of genes might be best suitable. That type of knowledge, as I sort of already emphasized, could then be used to look for alleles of these genes that exist naturally for breeding or also for genetic modification, one or the other. But the approaches through the genomics and omics revolution for identifying alleles and being able to make such improvements through breeding have become very powerful these days. So I'd like to finish by acknowledging, I think I mentioned Chi Yu and Ching Ching, who's played a very important role in the artificial microRNA screen, Felix Hauser, who developed this platform in my laboratory, Paolo Siciliato, who's helped with propagating this platform and also pilot screens, and other present and former lab members who now have their own groups or their new positions. We've collaborated in this work with Ron Evans, as I mentioned, Raina Meyer, Priyanka Kushwaha, Pam Ronald, and we also have other collaborations here that I didn't mention today that I could present at another time. So thank you very much for your attention and time.
Great. Thank you so much for your presentation. That was excellent. We have a number of questions coming in, and I want to encourage the participants to continue to submit questions via the Q&A pod in the lower right-hand corner of the screen. So I'll just get started with the questions. We have a person who's asking about the triple CBF mutant and states it was resistant to arsenic-3. But you identified phosphate transporters, which would be arsenate transporters. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, so that's actually a very interesting question. So if we expose plants to arsenate, that can be taken up by phosphate transporters. And and phosphate itself is toxic, as it can interfere and compete with arsenate is toxic as it can compete with phosphate. At the same time, arsenate is reduced to arsenite, and that's actually quite important because arsenite can then be detoxified, for example, by the phytochelatins that bind arsenite, but not arsenate, and through the pathway that we described earlier. So when a plant both arsenate and arsenite are toxic, and because we have reductases that can convert the one to the other inside the plant, you can have both of these toxicants playing an important role.
Okay. I guess there was a follow-up question from the same person who wanted to know, did the single CBF mutants have an arsenic phenotype?
Right. So in our hands so far, no. We have not generated a quadruple mutant, as I mentioned, because it would be lethal. So at least at this point, we have not seen that. But this is ongoing research.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So at this point, I think I'm going to see if there is anyone who's on the telephone that wants to ask a question and continue to encourage folks to submit more questions in the Q&A pod while we check in with the folks on the phone. And as a reminder, if you are on the phone, you can take your phone off mute by pressing #6.
Right.
So is there anyone on the phone line?
Yeah.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah, you want to add something while
question.
We wait to see?
Yeah,
okay.
And that is that, so in a given mutant background, whether a mutant is sensitive to, say, arsenite or arsenate also depends on the nutrient content of your media. So we use different approaches. We use media that's fairly rich in nutrients. That actually reduces your sensitivity to some of these toxicants. But we also have developed a minimal media, which is perhaps more realistic for what plants experience in the soil. and there you actually have enhanced sensitivity. So when you're looking at different mutant combinations, as the question was, this may depend on the nutrient content. So this is something that we're still working on at this time.
Okay, great. Thanks for elaborating more on that. Was there anyone who was on the phone that wanted to ask a question? Just pause for a second here to see if anyone speaks up. No, it does seem like the majority of our participants use the online streaming, so but we do like to check in. Okay. Well, I'm not seeing any more questions coming in now from the audience. I don't know if our presenters have any, one just came in. Okay, let me go back here. This person says that drought resistant in plants is through stomatal regulation and some morphological changes. How is drought resistant expressed here?
Right, so, yeah, drought resistance is a quite complex trait in plants in general, and there are different mechanisms that contribute to drought resistance. The question was stomatal responses, so plants lose over 90% of their water through stomata. So stomatal regulation plays an important role in reducing or slowing water loss, but there are other very important traits linked to drought tolerance. Some of these are actually the ability of roots and to grow deeper into soils, to seek water that would be deeper in soils. And there are protective mechanisms because dehydration and the osmotic stresses linked to that can kill cells. And so plants mount resistance through genes where the biophysical mechanisms aren't completely understood yet, but drought resistance is quite a complex trait. Now, in the case of the phytostabilizer plants that Raina Meyer has been working on, these are plants that can withstand the very, not only drought, but the very low acidity of these toxic soils and the toxic metals in those soils and can grow. In general, in this case, these plants obviously also need to have a genetic makeup that can withstand the arid or semi-arid conditions in those regions. Now, our interest in this case are how these plants respond, or the interest, I should say, of Raina, are these plants were selected to grow in those regions, but then the question is, how do they phytostabilize and grow in the presence of these acidic pH and toxic metals? So Raina could do obviously a better job at that, but at the same time, very interesting studies of how the microbiome might play a role in facilitating that and in regulating the pH. But that's research in Raina Meyer's laboratory. So the main thing here is that plants that Raina has previously characterized can grow under these arid and semi-arid conditions.
Okay. Did have another question come in here for you. Has any of your work looked at arsenic sequestration from arsenic contamination in groundwater?
Yeah, so we ourselves have not worked on that. It is interesting that some plant species have an amazing ability to hyperaccumulate arsenic. So it was shown a number of years ago that some frond species can accumulate arsenic in their fronds a thousandfold higher than, in this case, the soil they grow in. Now, can you use plants to remove arsenic from waters? Obviously, you'd need those waters to be standing so that the plants have time. And I think this point was emphasized possibly on Monday that I think Bill Suk mentioned this, for bioremediation, you need time in order to remove, say, toxicants from soil. And in the case of waters, you'd probably want some kind of standing waters. You know, today, plants are used to remove nitrates and phosphates and so on from standing waters as a first step to cleanse waters. So I could imagine that that would be possible, but if it were, say, a flowing river, then the time, that would be another issue. Yeah,
that's a good point. Yeah, I remember a few years ago going to a Superfund site in Virginia that was using those fronds on an old apple orchard, I believe it was.
The fronds. Yeah.
Okay. I don't see any more questions right now. So I guess I'm going to open it up. If anyone has questions for either Claudia or Julian, you can submit some questions. Just be sure to let us know in your question who the question is directed to, and we will read those aloud to the presenters. And while we're waiting to see if anyone submits any more questions, I guess I'll ask the speakers if you have any closing remarks or any last things that you would like to share with us. Okay. Well, I'm not seeing any more questions coming in. I want to thank both of our presenters for two wonderful presentations today that, as we mentioned, will be archived. And I guess before we conclude, I just want to make sure that everyone is aware and has seen the related URLs pod, which is on your screen above the Q&A pod. And it contains the seminar resources, links to seminar feedback. On the seminar resources page, we've assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. And these resources will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We place the seminars in an archive with the soundtrack. So in the near future, you're going to be able to access these slides and hear the presentations as it was given today. Also in that related URLs pod, you'll find an online seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form, as we do look at your comments when we're continuing to try and improve the content and delivery mechanisms. We can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. I also want to remind participants of various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any webinars. For more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the CLUIN.org website. You can also subscribe to a free monthly e-newsletter, TechDirect, and follow CLUIN on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. We encourage you to visit the SRP Risk e-learning webpage for information about upcoming sessions, and you can also follow SRP on Twitter. We want to encourage everyone to join us on October 11th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for the final session of this series. The third session is going to highlight new and emerging tools to improve existing bioremediation, such as nanotechnology, novel field approaches, and machine learning. We will hear from Dr. Pedro Alvarez at Rice University, Dora Taggart from the SRP-funded Small Business Microbial Insights, and Amin Razavi from the SRP-funded Small Business Micro-V Biotechnologies. If you would like to join this webinar, you can register now. If you cannot attend, archives will be made available after the event, so we encourage you to come back to these pages for links to the archives after the webinars are held. With that, it's time to conclude today's webinar. If you submitted an online question and we did not get to it, we'll pass those questions on to the presenters who can follow up. If you do have some additional questions that come to you after the presentation, you can contact the presenters via email. Their email addresses are on the seminar homepage on CLUIN, on the main registration page where you signed up. I want to thank our presenters, Claudia Gunsch and Julian Schroeder, for their time preparing and sharing their presentations with us. That concludes today's presentation, and thank you all for your participation, and enjoy the rest of your day.